it what we found. It's a big sound in a small town. Far from the bright lights, they're making music every night. Hear what is all around. It's a big sound in a small town. It's a big sound in a small town. It's a big sound in a small town.
Hi, and welcome to Big Sound Small Town. I'm your host, Sandy Carlton, and this is a podcast about the lives and stories of the musicians, writers, artists, and their associates that have their roots in the small towns and communities across America. If you like what you hear, tell somebody. Enjoy.
My name is Yulia Price, and I'm a classically trained violinist. I've been playing the violin since I was 4 years old, and I first started playing violin because actually my mom was really interested in violin. I wasn't so much interested being 4 years old. Mm-hmm. And so I started playing, and she started playing with me. She learned alongside me until I was about, I don't know, probably 8 or 10 is probably when she stopped, you know, learning and taking lessons with me. But she, along with my teacher, basically kind of taught me.
Right.
So I was, I don't know if you've heard the Suzuki method.
Yes, but, I know all about it.
Oh, yeah, your grandson's right in it with me. Right.
It's a great method to learn.
Yeah,
I mean,
it is.
I agree. It's great for that.
Yeah, and it the one really good thing about Suzuki is it trains your ear.
It does.
So you have really good pitch and just a good feel for musicality. So that's one great thing about Suzuki. But so she taught me, and about probably 6th and 7th grade is when I actually started to get really interested in violin, and I joined a youth orchestra, the Charlotte Youth Symphonies.
Right.
So I joined that, and I guess I got more and more interested and started practicing more and kind of took off from there.
At the beginning, did you, when you were 4, was it fun? Was it something that was fun?
Oh, no. I actually hated.
Okay.
I hated practicing. I hated the violin as a kid growing up because I saw it as a chore.
I do understand.
You know, no kid wants to just practice scales.
Piano lessons was that way for me. I was bad to memorize the piece as opposed to reading it. Which is a terrible thing to do, but I did learn to read music, both violin and piano, but I always felt that was a chore.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, as
did you guys just when you were small, your mom just got the Suzuki books and y'all went through those? Did you have a teacher right off?
So I had a teacher when I started as a 4-year-old. So I actually started on a butter box. Like my mom made me, you know, the fake violin out of a butter box. And I just held it for the first few months because I was really young, you know. And then, you know, I got like a 16th size violin?
Yes.
So I got that. But yeah, I had a violin teacher initially starting out, but my practice basically consisted of like my mom would, you know, write all the violin pieces and put it in a box, and I had to like pick out like 10 songs every day and play them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you always had actually pretty serious practice.
Yeah, so she sat with me every day as a kid while I practiced, and I think that's part of why I was able to improve a lot as a kid, just because she was there guiding me through practice. Because, you know, as a 4 or 5 or 6 year old, no kid's going to have structured practice.
Right. And I guess it helped that your mom was involved. I mean, that is pretty cool.
Yeah, she knew, you know, kind of how to help me since she was also taking the lessons. And so that was really helpful.
So when did it become fun for you?
So it really became fun when I started playing orchestra. I think, you know, playing Suzuki music, you're playing by yourself all the time, and there's no like social component to it.
Right.
And then when I started playing an orchestra, you know, the music is much more complex. There's layers of music, and you know, there's also a social component to it. You're making music with someone, and there's a lot of communication involved in that. Yeah, so I think that's what got me really interested in music, is just orchestra.
And that would have been it. What age?
Probably 6th, 7th grade. I joined the Charlotte Youth Symphony. I want to say I joined the Junior Youth Symphony in 6th grade, I think.
Okay.
And then I transitioned to the older symphony when I was in 9th grade, maybe 8th, 9th grade.
So you had to travel to do that already.
Yeah. So, and then around that same time, 6th, 7th grade, I moved on to my next teacher.
Right.
And I think, you know, that's important for any musician.
Yes, it is. I mean, I think that, the things that I've found that is important in music is to play with people better than you.
Yes.
And to find you a teacher at whatever level that you're at.
Yes. I think too many times, like, students get comfortable where they're at. And then, you know, the teacher, of course, you know, the teacher has helped them to get to that point. But you always need a teacher that's a good few steps.
Yes. Yeah, challenging you more.
Yeah.
And I think you get used to a teacher's style after a while, to where it also becomes, I wouldn't say mindless practice, but not pushing yourself very far. Mm-hmm. I mean, I took a orchestra job for a while.
Oh, nice.
Playing upright bass. And we changed orchestra leaders, but rather than read the music, I continued to play what I played for the other band leader. And then finally, one of the horn players said, "You realize you're not playing a dadgum thing on the," you know, and I said, "Well, it's the same songs." And he says, "He's going to call you out." And he did. And he said, "If you want to keep this job, if you go home and you read what I've written out, if the parts you're playing are better, then I'll let you continue doing them." And you know what? His parts were way better.
That's funny.
You know, so I learned my lesson, and I was pretty old at that time.
Mm.
So I learned that different teachers, different band directors have a whole different feel on the same songs. They just... When you, and I know that you're to this point, well past this point, but there's so many things, even classically, that are each band leader or teacher probably has a different slant on it.
Yeah.
Even though classic is pretty rigid, that it needs to be played this way, there's always that little, each teacher has a little different approach to it.
I 100% agree. So I think, you know, you said classical music is pretty rigid, and I would agree with that. You know, you're expected to play in a certain style. Like, yes, if you're playing Mozart, you know, you should be playing light and airy, and there's right. all these rules that you have to follow, especially with, you know, with classical music compared to jazz or, right. you know, fiddling or whatever. But
there's not a lot of improvisation in classical. I mean, and that's the whole idea, though. People wrote the music to be played this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I would agree that, you know, each teacher has a different approach to it, because my technique, as I've changed teachers over the years, is shifted every time. And, you know, the thing about music, and especially violin playing, you're constantly reevaluating how you're playing and changing your setup and,
sure
you know, listening to how you're producing the sound. So it's, it, you know.
And I guess with the instrument, in your case, I guess with the instrumentation that you have to play with, you have to play totally different than if you play alone.
Yes, I agree with that too. You know, playing solo is a completely different experience and type of playing from orchestral music.
Oh, I mean, totally.
You know, when you're playing an orchestra, you can't just do whatever you
do.
No,
you can't. And you have to find a blend, really, that fits in there and doesn't actually go against the grain of what's happening, even though you're playing the same. I think drummers have that too. Drummers, they're tasked with more than just counting time. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's fitting in a pocket type deal. And
mm-hmm.
violinists, and also, okay, pretty early in your life, you became like a first chair, a lead.
I guess so. Yeah, so I, junior youth orchestra, I guess 6th to 8th grade, I got more serious. And then by the time I was in 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, you know, I was concertmaster for, you know, Charlotte Symphony Youth Orchestra. Yeah. I was in high school and, you know, whatever groups
I played in. Was that a more challenging deal for you? I mean, did you feel more pressure that way?
Well, yeah, okay, on the high school level, I didn't feel any pressure,
right.
but,
yeah.
you know, at, you know, Charlotte Symphony Youth Orchestra and, you know, competing in Allstate, you know, there's some degree of pressure that comes with being a concert master
right.
or being first chair, but also, I think for me, I was more focused on becoming the best, I guess, solo player that
right.
you can be, because especially in high school and an undergraduate, the point is to become, you know, technically solid and musically
sure.
solid on the instrument. So it's not so much about chairs, but I mean, there is added pressure. So
as opposed to being, I mean, when you are the concert master, I mean, it all kind of revolves around you. I mean, the rest of it just is there to back you up.
I agree to some extent. So the concertmaster's job is to help the orchestra, you know, stay together.
Right.
And it's also to lead the string section, you know,
right.
the your own violin section. But I also think that the most important players are the ones who actually sit in the back of the orchestra.
I kind of agree with that, but you do get all the cool solos.
Yeah, I do get all the cool solos, but yeah, sitting in the back, that's where the sound comes from. If the back isn't with the concertmaster, then it's just going to fall apart. So I always find that, for me, actually playing in the back of the orchestra is much more difficult than being concertmaster. Even though being concertmaster, you have to have a specific set of skills, you know, leadership qualities that help the orchestra to work together well. And, you know, the concertmaster also has the job of interpreting what the conductor is doing.
True.
And that's probably the most important job.
It is. And that is actually I would think that would be a kind of stressful, more so than the actual playing of the notes is too.
It can be. I mean, it depends. So some conductors I've had are very clear, you know, exactly what
right.
they want, you know, when they do the downbeat, you know, exactly when to play, you know, how they want it to sound.
Right.
But if the conductor isn't as, you know, proficient, then it gets really difficult. So it can be stressful.
I guess that's just all comes down to communications, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And it's a different kind of communication,
It is. I mean, it is a musical communication, which is, it's still communication and still language, but this is really good because a lot of people never know the wherewith of what goes on with an orchestra of any type.
Yeah.
You know, you just go out there and everybody practices hard and, you know, some people play their specific parts, but they don't get the insight.
Yeah. I think that one of the biggest things that people, misconceptions that people have is that the conductor has the easiest job. And I think that that's, you know, really hilarious because, you know, of course it looks easy. They're just waving their arms around, but really the conductor knows every single part. How many parts is that? Like 30, 40 parts, you know, exactly what everyone's doing at every second. And he's the one that's interpreting the music. And then the concert master and the section leaders take that and show the rest of the orchestra how the music should be molded and formed. And
that is a part too that people really miss too is getting everyone to play I'm trying to put this where my people can get, but you know, it's more than playing the notes. You want there's dynamics is where I'm going, which is hard to build in any type of music. I mean, to get your parts to fit together, to get your section to play soft, loud. I mean, it is that's a chore in itself.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you think especially certain composers, the shifts will be so fast, like emotionally it'll just a few measures will be sweet and then all of a sudden it's angry or, you know, whatever the emotional shift is in the piece, you know. It's very hard for all that to be together with 100+ players.
I agree. And you know, I guess also it's easy when there's that many people to get your set to break concentration, you know. I'm not playing at this moment and I wonder what's for supper. So, I mean, that's a chore. It really is. And the conductor, really, that's a whole part of his task is to keep everybody focused.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So, okay. Now, we're in high school and we're going to Charlotte to play.
Uh-huh.
Is this becoming pretty much your life?
I wouldn't say in high school that it was my complete focus. I did a lot of, you know, other sports and I liked to be social. But it did take a good part of my time, especially my weekend, Saturday, Sunday, Monday was pretty much gone. But, you know, I sometimes regret that I didn't practice more in high school.
Really?
I could have been much more serious.
Right.
I mean, because, you know, especially when you're competing on a very high level, there's going to be kids who are practicing 6 hours a day, you know.
I mean, there are always those.
So sometimes I regret that. But I also think to be a musician, you need to have many types of experiences because your life experiences, you know, influence the kind of music you're making.
It does.
And I always hope that my music is actually sharing something or, you know, I'm sharing a part of myself and my experiences. And if I don't have, you know, my own experiences to draw from, then, you know, how can you make meaningful music?
How can you put the emotion there if you haven't had the emotional experience of
some
type? I mean,
and a lot of times, especially in classical music, you hear kids that are so extraordinarily talented. I mean, they could play circles around me, but somehow they're missing the musical and emotional component.
Sure.
So technically, they could be just 100,000% solid, but, you know, you have to have that extra something to your playing.
Every form of music has that. It's I know a lot of really talented musicians and some know how to play and some just play. and mm-hmm. their skills are fabulous. It's just that there's no feeling to it.
Yeah.
And with you'll have to help listeners here. Your violin tones. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, let's back up and do a instrument progression. I mean, we started with the little homemade deal.
Oh yeah, you know, just to practice holding it, the little butter box.
The little butter box,
mm-hmm.
and then let's as you develop your skill and your tones. Do you go and seek of the holy grail of
violin
tone? Yeah.
So, you know, obviously when you start off with a 16th size violin, you know, the sound's just not going to be that great. It's just too small. But, you know, you progress and you go 8th size and half size and 3/4 size. And, you know, it gets bigger and bigger. And gradually the sound starts to open up and, you know, you start to sound more full and mature as a player. And then when you get to a full size violin, obviously, you know, you want to choose a violin that's suited for your playing. And personally, I like a violin that's a bit warmer in its sound and kind of rich and dark. But, you know, I think a lot of people also make the mistake of focusing too much on the instrument itself because you're the one that's really producing the tone.
Yeah. You are the one that, I mean, there's players who can make anything sound pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it's all in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just the way, you know, you pull the bow and the way you're able to use your weight on the violin, that all contributes to the tone. But right now, my current violin is, I would say it's a warmer sound. So I actually had a different full-size violin. My first full-size violin I got when I was in the 7th grade, I want to say. And it was a good violin for me at the time, mm-hmm. for my level.
Right.
But after a few years, I realized that the sound wasn't open enough. It was somehow a bit too closed.
Right.
And, you know, as you get better on the violin, you sort of reach a limit with a violin.
True with the violin.
Yeah. So I felt that I had reached my limit with that violin. So I got my current violin when I was in, I want to say, 9th grade, around there.
Right.
But this violin has been fantastic for me. I still feel that I'm growing into it.
That's great.
It's got a lot of, it can make very rich and beautiful sounds. And, you know, the violin, you know, like I said, tone is all about the way you're using your bow and drawing the sound out of the instrument. Kind of, I think of the violin as sort of like a live creature. You don't want to press on it because it's not going to like that. But if you just let the violin speak.
That's a good philosophy. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. If you just let the violin speak, then its natural sound will come out. So, you know, I love my current violin. It's very warm and rich. But I know some people prefer violins that are very bright sort of that exhilarating sound. And that's not so much my style of playing.
I understand that too. I have that similar feeling.
Yeah, so tone is an interesting thing with violins because, you know, I'm sure if there's a player that's more technically solid than me or, you know, somebody who's, I guess, at a higher level, they might play my violin and say, this one's not for me or I feel I've grown out of this instrument.
And I guess, too, it would depend on, I mean, you found one that works for you in every instance. You know, I'm sure that there's some times that you wish, I do wish I had a brighter violin for this piece of music mm-hmm. particularly or, you know, or working with these people.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes, especially if I'm playing a very technical show piece, like, I don't know, Paganini or something, sometimes I wish my violin was a bit somehow quicker to respond or a little bit brighter.
Right.
But overall, for my style of playing, my violin is very suited.
Let's go to bows, too. I mean, bows are very important.
Bows are important. You know, people don't realize how expensive bows can get. I will just throw out a few examples. My old teacher in high school had a bow that was $25,000.
Yes, I do
know. You know, and his bow, I think, was actually one of the four bows that was made for Princess Diana's wedding.
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
So the chamber group played with those specially made bows, and then somehow he acquired it and, you know, played on it and really liked it. But
did you ever get to play that bow?
I did. I got to play the bow.
And how was it?
You know, it was... Every bow, again, like a violin, is different, so
true.
Obviously... It had a different type of weight, and one thing about the bow that's important to me, at least, is where I feel the weight in the bow.
Yeah.
Sometimes the weight, you feel like it's in the middle of the bow. It
mm-hmm.
might be in the frog, which is
yeah.
the lower part of the bow, and then, or the tip. So, you know, the weight on that bow, it was pretty evenly distributed, I want to say, and... You know,
that's pretty good, actually. I
mean, yeah, and the balance point was good, so, you know, I would have had to play on it longer to really
sure.
understand
yeah.
the bow, but,
yeah.
yeah, bows are incredibly important
yes,
to violin playing.
Yes, they are. I spent nearly a lifetime collecting and reselling bows.
Oh, nice.
Just because of the bows are amazing to me. I mean, it and actually it's harder... For me to find good bows than it is violins, because
yeah.
there's incredible violins. Even new make violins are pretty incredible these days. Bows.
Yeah, bows are really tricky, I think.
They really are tricky.
You know, especially if you're looking for a bow, one of the biggest things I would suggest is make sure you're practicing like spiccato, which is, you know, the balancing
sure.
stroke or... just practicing different strokes, because even if it sounds and feels good on a normal stroke, it
right.
might not work for, like,
true.
You know, bouncing or martelet and such. So, yeah, bows are tricky.
Yeah, bows are really tricky. I mean, they really are. And it's basically a crapshoot, because you have to play them, you know. I mean, it's not like I can go get, or anyone can go get a new bow every day.
Oh, no.
Or it's not like, you can get, at your level, you can get bows on loan.
Yeah.
Which you can get enough time with it to find out,
mm-hmm.
well, this is a bow that I might like to keep. But most people, you know, it's like, I got to take a chance.
Yeah. Oh, that's so scary.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely, for the current bow I have, I took a loan on 6 bows and played them for
right.
a few months and finally came to my decision. But this is actually the one that I'm playing on now is my second bow. And unfortunately, and this happens too, is my main bow that I was using
mm-hmm.
actually snapped because there was a weakness in the wood.
Oh,
so
really?
You know, sometimes
well, I mean,
those things
happen, yeah.
happen too, and it really just snapped for no reason. So you know, things happen.
Yeah, they do. But I mean, that's you are lucky that there are places that will let you loan bows like that. I mean, so take us from some. Okay, in high school, you got to do some pretty good stuff that most high school orchestra players do not get to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So in high school, obviously, I got to sit concertmaster a lot for a lot of the groups I played in, which was really nice because I feel like I really learned how to show the music, which becomes really important, especially when you're playing small chamber music groups,
right.
which is just, you know, 4 or
sure.
3 or 5 people.
Yeah, it's totally different than playing with
yeah,
full
it's different
orchestra.
Than playing with full orchestra, but having, you know, being concertmaster taught me, you know, how to show the music and how to breathe and how to cue and
right.
all those sorts of things. And in high school, I also had the opportunity to go to several music festivals, which was really... really beneficial for me at the time. You know, there are high level violinists
right.
in North Carolina. I do not
right.
want to say there aren't.
I understand.
But,
yeah.
you know,
sure.
going to a big music festival, you're competing more on a national and
yeah.
sometimes international level.
True.
So it was really good for me to see kind of what's out there. And
yeah.
I, you know, I went to, I think, Brevard Music Festival when I was a sophomore, I want to say. Yeah, a sophomore. And that was a six-week music festival in the summer. And there I got to play under some great conductors and play for great teachers and, you know, kids that grew up in musical families were there. And, you know, I was just exposed to a whole world.
Oh, yeah. And you get to live that life for,
yes.
I mean, instead of having a... That is a really cool thing about that is you actually get to live the life. It's the, I don't have to go be anything but a violinist while I'm here. I don't have to go back and be, you know, I don't really have to do anything but absorb all this.
Yeah. And, so I went to Brevard Music Festival. I think my junior year I went to Interlochen Music Festival in Michigan. And then I went to Tanglewood Music Festival in Boston my senior year. And those are all really great experiences. And, you know, obviously in Boston, I got to listen to the Boston Symphony.
Sure.
We have free tickets and,
yeah.
You know, it was fantastic. But, you know, I do warn, I do have a few students or people who ask me on advice about music festivals. The biggest thing is you want to have a teacher that is invested in your growth while you're at a music festival.
Cool.
So, the way orchestral music festivals are set up is that normally you have 3 or 4 hours of orchestra rehearsal each day. Normally it's 3. And then you're usually put in a chamber group, so you're also doing chamber group rehearsals. So usually you're going to be in a quartet, which is 4 people.
Yeah.
And then you're also having private lessons maybe once or twice a week with a teacher. So if anybody says to me they want to go to a big music festival, I always say make sure you find a good teacher first, because that's who's going to be helping you grow as a musician the most.
Right.
Though, of course, you want to, you know, go for the orchestra portion of it, because that gives you experience in itself, but you want to have a teacher who is really knowledgeable so that you're actually improving in the right ways.
Right, rather than just going and having fun.
Yeah.
I mean, which would be what you could do easily.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I'm here to learn, but yeah, I want to have a good time.
Yeah. I mean, you could do both.
But I think you can. I do. I do feel you can do both.
Yeah.
So,
you know, music festivals, I think, can be very beneficial, but you need to always be aware of the teachers that you could be placed with, and you need to be aware of what exactly you want to get out of it.
Right.
Because you could go to an orchestra festival, you could go to a solo focus festival, you could go to chamber music. So you really need to think about what it is that you want to improve
on. The ones you want to go to.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess a lot of that. Okay, at some point you decided that music was what you wanted to pursue, right?
Yes.
I mean, you're still in high school and you decided that I'm pretty good at this. Because obviously, I mean, you've been pretty confident about your ability for a pretty good while, right?
For a little bit, I guess.
Yeah. So once you gain the confidence and some knowledge, then you decide this is what I want to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in high school, so what do you do next?
So, I went through auditions. I auditioned for a few conservatories as a high schooler, applying to college.
Right.
So I auditioned for a few conservatories, which are basically just classical music schools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they focus completely on music. And then I auditioned for one state school, which is East Carolina University, which is where I'm at now. The audition process was something that was a bit new to me as a high schooler.
I suppose you never had to do that.
Because I had never had to go through anything like that before. But for high schoolers, the audition process, basically you have to learn 2 movements of a Bach sonata or partita, and then a movement of a concerto, a Paganini caprice. And that's basically the standard for auditioning for undergrad. So that was a new thing for me, because as a high schooler, that was kind of a lot of music for me to prepare at one time. So it was difficult, but it was a good experience. But I ended up, I kind of knew I wanted to go to ECU because, again, in the same way that it's important to have a good teacher at a music festival, you need to have a teacher in college that actually cares about you and is invested, because too many times I see music students go to big name or brand name schools, and no one's actually looking after them or helping them, I guess.
Yeah, oh, yeah, I do know.
Because, you know, music is obviously a difficult career path.
Very difficult career path.
Yeah, and you really need to have somebody to guide you through that. And, you know, these brand name schools, yes, they're known for a reason, and they have very high level musicians, but sometimes if you're not the top of the top, then you get overlooked.
Yeah, you do. You don't learn as much as you should learn.
Yeah.
And it's probably even easier to get burnt out. I mean, music is hard.
It's very, very difficult. I mean,
and it's time consuming. It is. No one becomes great without a lot. I don't care how much talent you have. People do not see the amount of time that musicians put in.
And it's all wonderful, good. Many,
they see
many
you
years.
On stage, and it's so wonderful, but.
Yeah, that doesn't just happen. There's a big misconception in general in the arts, I think, that it's just talent and people just go out there and do it. But, you know, it's actually just a culmination of hundreds of hours of work.
And
same thing for painters, you know.
I agree.
I know that a lot of these painters spent hundreds of hours on their artwork, but people just think, oh, they just did that, you know.
Oh, yeah, they do. Well, I feel the same. I spend a lot of time with artists of all types, and pretty much the bottom line is anyone can play music or write or paint at a fun level. All the arts can be acquired by anyone, but there's no mastering of any of it. I mean, you hear of masters, but there's no mastering of it. It's just lots of practice. I mean, I'm sure that you know your violin fretboard inside out, because you know every little piece of it, because you spent so much time on it. And violinists are that way more so than any other, because usually you play the same violin. Where we'll take a guitarist, they'll play several different guitars.
Mm-hmm.
Violinists, you're pretty well, you reach a point where you're pretty locked to that instrument. So you become,
I would have a very hard time switching to another violin at this point.
Yeah, and I mean, you know every little piece of that fretboard and what it's going to do.
So it's
okay. Now, at East Carolina, tell me about being there.
So actually at ECU, I've had a lot of ups and downs. So, you know, with practicing a lot, I got really injured actually freshman year. So I got, which, you know, it's pretty common with musicians, but somehow it's not talked about too much. I got tendonitis my freshman year. So what I should have done is just taken freshman year off and been like, you know, I'll come back in a year or something, and, you know, just done other things I enjoyed or taken other classes. But I was very determined to play, so I played on and off both my freshman and sophomore years, and then junior year I finally got to the point where I was like, I can't play anymore, you know, it hurt too much. So I took junior year off, and then after that I healed up for the most part.
Did you have to have surgery or anything?
I did not. I had some tests, you know, and they're never sure, you know, with these types of injuries, because they're all, you know, tendon and muscle related. So they weren't really sure. And, you know, I went through a lot of different kind of therapy, PT, OT, massage therapy, acupuncture.
Did you get nervous about all this at this point? I mean, did you think, I possibly may have to make a career change?
I did. I ended up actually adding two other majors, just, you know, during my junior year while I was taking time off from violin.
Right.
I was, you know, thinking, I still don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. And even if I end up not doing violin one day, I've kind of become okay with that, just because, you know, there's always ways to be involved with chamber music, orchestra, and all those sorts of things. But, you know, I came back senior year and ended up getting back into the swing of things, and I felt pretty okay. So, This year, I guess this is my fifth year since I took junior year off. I am going to be having both my junior and senior recital this year, and I will be, I'm currently auditioning for grad school. It's for violin. So, yeah, I guess it worked out. But, you know, injuries are very common in the music world, and I didn't realize that, I think, especially when I was younger, high schooler, those things aren't talked about. I mean, you think of sports injuries, and it's kind of the same because it you're using your...
I mean, and it's basically an overuse type thing.
Yeah.
You know, that, that but then you have to, I mean, you have to do it. I mean, it comes with it, I think.
Yeah.
You know?
I know, basically my teacher, who is very, very encouraging, and if probably not for him, I would have given up on violin with all the injuries stuff that I had going on. He told me that basically every single violinist at some point in their life is going to get injured because, you know, it's like a sport. You're using your small muscles 6 to 8 hours a day.
Sure.
You know, vibrato is, you know, kind of bad for your arm.
Yeah. Well, and I know several violinists with neck problems.
Yeah, neck problems, you know, back problems.
Yeah,
it's
back
very
problems,
common.
Yeah. I mean,
so, but, you know, I guess if I had to give people advice, the biggest thing is always warm up before you start practicing, and don't practice for more than an hour straight. Always
I think that's good. I'm glad you said that, because
15-minute breaks.
You know, there are people who want to put in 6 hours a day and then they don't pick it back up for a couple of days, as opposed to
consistent practicing over time.
I think consistent practice as opposed to long lengths of time actually work better retaining wise, and you know, it's I think it that's a better approach. However, when you're young, you're still going to do that.
Now I never do more. I mean, when I was, especially at music festivals in high school, I was putting in a lot of hours, so it makes sense to me that I got injured.
Cumulative, I guess, is what it became, really.
Yeah, it was just too much on my arms. But now, you know, I really emphasize this in for any students I have, you really need to be practicing just consistently, even if it's an hour a day.
Sure.
That's much better than cramming.
Yeah, I agree.
The famous violinist, Itzhak Perlman, I think it was Itzhak Perlman, said that he only practices 45 minutes and then he takes 15-minute break. And he only practices like 4 hours a day or something.
Yeah.
I think, I want to say it was Itzhak Perlman. But yeah, that just goes to show it's more about how you're focused and how you're practicing instead of how much.
Yeah, so. It is. I mean, but it is. I mean, practice can be tedious. You know, it's one of those things. And I know that sometimes you're wondering if you're even practicing what you should be.
Especially after my injury, I examined sort of how I was practicing more. And it's really important to have sort of a game plan when you're practicing, especially, you know, at a higher level, because you're learning so much music at once. You have so much to get through, and you got to sit down and be like, what is it that I really need to nail down, or what is it that I need to learn today? And
that part is most difficult for me.
You don't want to just be playing through stuff all the time, because that doesn't actually help you get better. So
so you at this point do not know where you're going to grad school at?
I do not yet. So I...
Are they in different parts of the country?
They are all in different parts of the country. So basically, most of them are conservatories and a few schools that are known for music, but they're still, you know, public, I guess, not conservatories.
Right.
But I'm in the middle of it. So I've passed all of my pre-screening so far, and I guess I'll explain it for listeners, I guess, may not know.
Good.
So normally for violin, especially more competitive schools, you'll have two rounds. So the first round is obviously when you submit, you know, your essays and all that kind of thing, but you also submit your initial pre-screening videos.
Mm-hmm.
And for grad school, the standard is basically a full concerto, which is about 40-45 minutes. two Bach. I have to play a Bach fugue, a Paganini caprice, a modern piece. So that's about an hour and a half worth of music. I mean, it's a lot. Yeah. And
that's not simple music we're talking
about. Oh, no. It's very, very technically challenging.
It's very technically challenging, yeah. Yes.
Oh, and you also may need a sonata for some schools. I forgot about that. Mm-hmm. But so I sent a lot of those things in for my pre-screenings. You know, some of the requirements are different for each school, but it's basically those things. So that the pre-screening round is the first round, and they listen to your video, and they sort of weed out the people who, you know, they may not be able to handle the curriculum at conservatory.
If they're struggling with what they're sending in, then they're not,
And they pass the people who have a chance of getting in conservatory, who they think may be equipped to handle, you know, the challenges of conservatory. So I've passed all of my pre-screenings, so we'll see what happens to auditions. And auditions, usually they are live, so usually you have to travel to the school, but you know, this year with COVID and everything, I'm going to be having a lot of Zoom auditions, so it'll be interesting.
The good thing is you're living a part of history. And truthfully, at some point they'll probably go, the Zoom world is taking over, so
it really is. You know, in some ways it's a good thing because saved thousands of dollars without having to travel. So.
I agree. I mean, you don't have to tell me which one, but do you have one that is your preferred choice?
Well, I do. I would love to go. There's two schools that I would love to go to. I will say one's in Chicago and one's in New York. Okay. So I'll give you a clue there.
Both of them are in just a little bit bigger city.
Just a little bit bigger cities,
Than Greenville. Yeah.
So. And, you know, I have to say, although I've had a lot of ups and downs at ECU, I will say my teachers at ECU are phenomenal. And I might be a little biased, but I truly think my teacher, Ari Gagorian, and Hejin Kim, I think they're the best violin teachers in the state. They really pushed me, but knew when I was struggling and how to help me. And my teacher is Aura, but he really helped me through the whole injury. And of course, when you have an injury, it's like if you're an athlete and you get injured, it can be very debilitating.
My grandson went through that this year in soccer.
Playing
soccer in college, he got injured. So,
And it's hard.
And you do feel like you're not a part of it as directly as you once were. So,
yeah.
It's the same.
So, yeah.
Well, I'm glad that didn't sideline you. I'm glad you've gotten over that. So.
Yeah. So, yeah.
That's great. Well, I know it's a holiday season and I know you're returning, but I do appreciate you coming and taking the time to do this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you.